Hello, everyone, and welcome to the MMCP webinar on Wednesday, May 8th. We have some great questions to go over and some cases to discuss tonight, which I am looking forward to. So what I will do is I'm going to begin by answering a question around food sensitivity testing. And this question is related to all the different types of food sensitivity testing out there. There's ELISA testing, there's IgG testing, there are a bunch of different, there's LEAP testing, there's different labs that do IgG testing in different ways, there's IgE testing, there's IgA testing, there's complement testing. So when it comes to food sensitivities, allergies, how do we sort through that? What testing do we use? When do we use that testing? What considerations do we have for a sequence of tests to do? And those are all really important variables. So first, I want to say that there's a differentiation between food sensitivities and food allergies, and that's really an important thing to discern between. And so when we're talking food allergies, some people talk food allergies, they're talking generally about sensitivities and allergies. Some people, when they say food allergies, they're actually talking about IgE type, immunoglobulin E type histamine response, immediate onset allergies, things that could manifest as anaphylactic shock in extreme examples, or could be things that are sneezing, itching, rashes, those kinds of allergies. Now, IgE allergies, I like to make that discernment. I like to say IgE for allergies and then talk about sensitivities as IgGs, IgAs, other kinds of food immune reactivities. And that's a nice way to distinguish because there are some qualitative differences between those IgE responses and between other responses. So IgE responses from food allergies are typically going to be the immediate onset allergic responses. Severe ones, people will typically already know that they have. But minor ones, they may not. We do, in the clinic here, use a lot of blood IgE testing, and we do find some allergic responses in people that they don't know that they have, that when we eliminate those foods or those environmental allergen exposures, that people do feel better. So that is something important to begin to think about testing for our IgE allergies, even though the severe ones are obvious and people may already know that they have a severe one if they have it. So for me personally, growing up, I react to cashews in a way that's like an anaphylactic type of reaction. Tongue tingles, lips start to swell, throat will start to swell. But it's so immediate that I know after I have one bite of something that has cashew in it, because I immediately start to feel my tongue tingling, and I know it's either actually cashew or pistachio for me. I know it has one of those two in it, and I'll start to investigate and ask, hey, does this have this or this in it? And inevitably it does when I feel that sensation. So the IgE type severe reactions people tend to know. The less severe reactions they may not know. So getting a panel of IgE in the blood is fairly easy to do. Now, an allergist may do IgE skin prick testing as well. And that's where the skin is pricked with substances and the histamine response is estimated by how irritated and red and the skin gets at the site of the irritation. So that's another way to test for IgE allergies. Because it's because the testing's come a long way for blood IgEs, and it's so convenient, and insurance often pays for a lot of it or all of it in some cases, if you can get insurance to pay for the tests that you're ordering, that's always a bonus. So we, our standard initial blood panel that we order in the clinic does include some basic food IgEs and allergen respiratory IgEs. And I can't tell you the number of times that I've had someone come up with an IgE reaction to either dog or cat hair, who the person has a dog or a cat who is allergic to that dog or cat, who knows that they're allergic to that dog or cat, who has an high IgE total in their blood, meaning it's excessive histamine in general overburdening their system, and who's unwilling to get rid of that animal. So that's just something that you might deal with. I know we have dealt with in the clinic, and in those cases, I always recommend a very, very high quality air purifier and maybe pet-free zones in the home and maybe getting rid of carpets and only doing hardwood floors or tile and being diligent about cleaning and, you know, realizing that some of their symptoms, especially histamine-related symptoms, like a certain level of fatigue and some brain fog and a certain susceptibility to rashes and or sneezing or itching, may just be a part of their condition, their situation. They have to accept that if they're going to want to continue to have that animal. And we can do some work to reduce IgE reactivities over time. It's not easy, and it doesn't always reduce. So IgEs are conventionally thought of to be typically permanent. Sometimes childhood IgE allergies do not translate into adulthood, so there's a shift, and sometimes there's a late onset of an IgE reaction that wasn't there in childhood that becomes an issue in adulthood. But outside of that transition between childhood and adulthood, it's conventionally and typically thought that IgEs are permanent. But there is some research, and that research has begun to start to see the ability to make some changes in IgEs, mainly probiotics, certain kinds of probiotics, and fish oil have been two of the big ones. It's possible that vitamin A may play a role as well. That's not well researched, but it makes sense that the T regulatory cell regulations from vitamin A may impact benefit for IgE reactivity. So probiotics, omega-3 fatty acids, and omega-3-6 ratios may be helpful. Vitamin A may be helpful. And it's possible that other things like immunoglobulins could be helpful as well. Again, not a lot of research, and it'll depend on how severe the reactivity is. General functional medicine principles are still going to apply. In order for us to be able to treat and help to reduce the to reduce IgE reactivity, we're going to want to be able to overall reduce the histamine bucket. We have a question here about which kinds of probiotics can help reduce IgE reactions. Well, typically we're going to use some of the strains of IgE that are, or sorry, the strains, it's usually in the lacto-bifido class of probiotics that are the ones that tend to be helpful for overall IgEs. So you'll want a multi-strain with some lacto-bifido strains. So it's generally those high strains that have a little, those lacto-bifido strains that have the little bit of research on overall IgE. And what I would do is I would combine that with the research that there is on histamine lowering, degrading probiotics versus histamine producing probiotics. So when we're looking at the animal studies that show T regulatory cell activation, things like Lactobacillus casei, Lactobacillus reuteri, Bacteroides fragilis are some that have some studies there. The ones to potentially avoid, though, do have a little bit of overlap. So Lactobacillus casei, it can improve T cell activity, so it's probably good, but it can also produce some histamine, so there may be some issue there. Lactobacillus bulgaricus is one that can produce histamine, so that might be one to avoid. But Lactobacillus plantarum, Lactobacillus rhamnosus, most of the bifidobacter species. So I really like HN019 is a really great bifidobacter probiotic that has a promotility component to it. So it's really good with overall gut health, and it can help with degrading histamine as well. And then some of the soil-based organisms may be helpful. Bacillus subtilis is one that may be helpful. And also Saccharomyces boulardii may be helpful. So those are some to think about in terms of probiotics dealing generally with IgE, and then also thinking about the overall histamine bucket. And when we're looking at the, or thinking about the overall contribution of histamine from an IgE allergy and from other things, we want to reduce that bucket. So those are some of the big things that we're going to want to consider with IgE reactivities, and we're going to want to consider, is it in the broader context of histamine intolerance and total IgEs being high and histamine in the blood being high and maybe DAO levels being low. So for example, the Dunwoody Advanced Intestinal Barrier Permeability Test is a good screen to see if histamine levels are high and DAO levels are low, in which case you're going to focus your treatment, if DAO is low, on being sure you're adding copper and vitamin B6 as cofactors that help with lowering histamine. You're going to want to have some vitamin C and some quercetin in there, and that's going to be something to consider in those cases. In another case, you may have an IgE reaction that does not have an overall histamine intolerance or mast cell activation syndrome, and the total IgEs look normal. Person does not have symptoms of histamine issues. In those cases, you'll just want to focus more on a probiotic with high amounts of bifido strains, and then some of the Lactobacillus plantarum, Lactobacillus strains that are some of the helpful strains in general, plantarum and rhamnosus in particular, plus bifidobacter species for generally an IgE reaction without a histamine issue at play as well. So consider, if you're considering the bigger histamine question, it's good to have some additional data, like, are total IgEs in the blood high? Is histamine in the blood high? Is the DAO in the blood low? What's the histamine DAO ratio in the blood look like? Do people have symptoms of histamine intolerance? Do they get worse with fermented foods and shellfish and pineapple and some of the histamine-rich foods? So those are all going to be considerations to bring into the picture if histamine looks to be an issue, which it won't necessarily be in an IgE reaction overall an issue. It might only be acutely an issue when a person takes in that particular substance that they have an IgE reaction against. So those other labs like the total IgE, histamine, DAO, et cetera, can help you see, is it a bigger picture issue of histamine or is it a smaller picture issue of an isolated IgE reaction to a substance? I've talked to some of the people who produce Megaspore Biotic, and some of the other spore-based probiotics may also have a similar effect, where they argue that there may be some ability for certain spore-based probiotic species, when taken simultaneously to an allergen, to help present it to the immune system in a certain way that reduces the immune activity. I don't know if there's solid research on that. It may be still in the theoretical side of things, but I've considered the possibility of spore-based probiotics plus immunoglobulins together with a minor allergen food in order to see about helping the immune system interpret it a little differently. We know very, very low doses of an IgE are given as allergy shots, and those allergy shots can produce something called IgG4 over time, and that IgG4 can block some of the IgE response so that someone who, let's say they're allergic to cats and they've gotten allergy shots for a long time with just a tiny bit of cat dander and cat saliva, just a tiny bit, tiny bit, tiny bit, tiny bit over time, the immune system generates this IgG4. IgG4 can sit on those IgE receptors and can block that IgE allergic response, which means that someone may not have symptoms from eating that food, even though they have an IgE elevation. So, for example, the Dunwoody antigen test has IgG4 specifically measured out so that you can see if an IgE may have a blocking potential. So that can be helpful to know IgG4 specifically subclass 4 so that you can know if there might be a blocking potential. And there's likely to be a blocking potential if, for example, someone used to have a reactivity to an IgE allergen, got allergy shots for a period of time, and does not have a reactivity anymore. Often that's the case, is that their body is built up with an IgG4 response. That may also be helpful in the case of pet allergies, where someone's around the pet and been around the pet a long time. They may have developed some IgG4. They may have noticed symptoms initially, but not later. Still, we often do want an air purifier to reduce and keep it low dose exposure instead of higher dose exposure. So that can help in those cases. So that's IgE. Then we have IgG responses. And IgG responses are going to be responses that are focused on the part of the immune system that's a more delayed response. So rather than that histamine-based immediate response of IgE, IgG can be delayed 2 hours, 4 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours, even 48 hours. So there may be a delayed response. These are harder for people to determine on their own what IgG responses they might have, because they might feel something, but maybe it was from 2 meals ago, maybe it was from yesterday. It's hard to know exactly because you don't get that immediate response. So IgE responses are immediate. IgG responses are typically delayed to some degree. IgG responses tend to be lower in intensity. They don't tend to be life-threatening. They tend to be more inflammatory in nature and less histamine in nature. So they may not cause sneezing, itching, rashes. They don't cause things like anaphylactic responses. Instead, they tend to cause things like maybe diarrhea or maybe a skin response, like a low grade of eczema, but that's more chronic, not an immediate rash that then goes away, more like a low grade dermatitis or eczema that can come up, or like a breakout, like an acne breakout, maybe a couple hours afterwards, there are some bumps. And if they eat more of that food, those bumps get more pronounced. And if they eat more of that food, they start to get acne here. That's a really common one with dairy, and an IgG response to dairy is forehead acne. So if someone complains of forehead acne, think food sensitivity and think dairy is number one in that case. Also think vitamin A deficiency, gut issues like SIBO or H. pylori, all the other functional medicine stuff. It's really easy to get distracted by looking at one thing and trying to connect it to just one other thing. You want to always do the underlying root cause work, lab work, gut work is going to really, really commonly be playing a role. But typically, skin breakouts on the forehead relate a lot to food sensitivities. Skin breakouts more chin and mouth often are more hormonally related to reproductive hormone issues. So look a little deeper, reproductive hormone issues for those breakouts that are cyclical by the month around a certain time of month and that are more around the mouth and chin. Be more on the lookout for dairy and other food sensitivities for breakouts on the forehead. Also be looking at underlying gut issues. Now, IgG reactivities and testing has gotten a lot of criticism because it's not static or stable, meaning that it can change over time. Now, unfortunately, some lab testing has not been shown to be repeatable, where you can send the same blood in two different samples and get different results. There are certain labs that go further in double checking and being repeatable. And so some of the labs that are available today in the IgE testing world, I think are fairly reliable and repeatable for the same day, same person, but they do still change over time. You measure it next week, if you measure it next month, if you measure it 6 months from now, if you measure it a year from now, there are often a level of significance in the changes that happen. So some labs, for example, Cyrex lab will double test and they'll only show a positive if the two separate tests both show positive on the same sample. So some labs are going to test in higher levels of scrutiny that way. And then some labs like Vibrant and Dunwoody, you know, Vibrant's technology has very good sensitivity. I think Dunwoody does a pretty good job. So there are some labs that they tend to do a good job, but you have to, in general, take food sensitivity testing with a bit of a grain of salt. It's not perfect. The IgE testing is pretty good, but it's still not perfect. The IgG testing is even further from perfect. So you have to take it with a grain of salt. The tests, the ELISA tests and tests like LEAP are so far from perfect that I don't use them. I don't recommend that people pay any attention to them whatsoever. And I've had patients come in who have done them, who have done the diets, who have felt better. I have patients come in who have done them who have felt nothing. And the research has not shown that they're valid, that they're repeatable, that they're significant. And so in general, IgG testing has problems. ELISA testing has bigger, much, much bigger problems. And I categorize it as completely useless. So not completely useless. There's utility in anything that gets a person to change their diet and be intentional about foods they're eating and not eating and the elimination of certain foods, whatever those foods are, and they could be completely randomly chosen or they could be chosen by foods that tend to have large. In other words, I think you could get the same or better results by picking six foods and eliminating, let's say, gluten, corn, soy, dairy, eggs, and one other one that you suspect in that person's case might be playing a role. And you pick those six foods, you eliminate those six foods, zero testing, I believe you'll get better results than if you're going off of an ELISA test or one of the less proven tests. Now, if you're doing a higher quality IgG, IgA test, so IgA has no research that's significant behind it as well. So I have a little bit of a hard time with IgA testing, except for certain ones like some of the IgAs for celiac disease have been really well worked out. And so if we're looking at a tissue transglutaminase IgA for celiac, then yes, of course, that is valid. It's been validated. Some of the other IgAs, I don't know. I think it's if you get a test that measures them, if you do, let's say, a Cyrex test or a Vibrant America test that measures IgAs, I think, yeah, sure, try avoiding those foods, but don't like take it too seriously. Same with IgGs, but even more so for IgAs. There's just not evidence about IgAs. There's some evidence about IgGs. And then with IgGs, there's something also called complement. Complement can make an IgG reaction more severe. And so complement, there's only one lab that measures complement that I'm aware of, and that's Dunwoody at this point. So then you can see the IgG, and you can see if there's complement. And the IgG you take more seriously if there's also complement. And so complement is part of the immune system that has a different kind of reaction that synergizes with the IgG reaction that can make that reaction more significant, more severe. So for IgEs, we have IgG subclass 4 can make it less severe. For IgGs, we have complement can make it more severe. So those are things to consider when you're looking at food sensitivity testing. Now, sequencing is very important. If you do food sensitivity testing for someone who has SIBO or a gut infection because you did food sensitivity testing right off the bat, they could come up looking positive to almost everything just because they have a leaky gut and they're reacting and their immune system is generating antibodies against so many foods they're eating. If that's the case, it's almost useless. You've really wasted that person's money. It helps you see there's leaky gut, but there are easier ways and cheaper ways to see that there's leaky gut. So it's not useful to eliminate all those foods if someone's reacting to most things. For example, we had a person come in. He came in because his daughter was encouraging him to get food sensitivity testing specifically. So he came in and he wanted to get that. We said, well, you know, it's not going to be that useful if we don't first look for SIBO, look for parasites, look for infections, treat those, and then do the sensitivity testing. But he said, you know what, I want to do it all. I want to do SIBO, you know, and food sensitivities and stool testing all at once. And he said, sure, great. Food sensitivity came back showing positive to almost everything. He could eat some game and a couple of things, but it was almost nothing that he would have been able to eat if we had done that diet. So we didn't do that diet, but we did say, hey, we need to work on oral tolerance. We need to work on leaky gut. We did an oral tolerance protocol. We looked at things like, together with doing our SIBO treatment, we also looked at immunoglobulins. We looked at enzymes and stomach acid. We looked at glutathione. We looked at vitamin A. We looked at T regulatory cell function. We looked at vitamin D. We did some additional things that maybe we wouldn't have done otherwise, but for the most part, we would have treated fairly similarly the SIBO and the stool issues first. And then if there's lingering symptoms after we've treated those things, and then we've treated leaky gut and we've, you know, restored healthy gut function, and then there are still lingering symptoms, that's a great time to do a food sensitivity test. Still, the gold standard today is elimination diet, and that I will do with almost everyone from the very beginning in the clinic. When someone first joins, we'll often run a set of labs, and then when we get that lab work back in, we often will do some sort of elimination diet. We'll pick either autoimmune paleo or paleo or keto or Mediterranean, or we use sometimes potato hacking or potato diet. There's so many different diets that we use. We might do a modified paleo. We might do a gluten-free, dairy-free, sugar-free elimination. We might do gluten, dairy, sugar, corn, and soy. We might add in eggs. So these are the kinds of things that we'll do in almost every case that have great benefit. We might do low FODMAP, we might do SCD. So these kinds of diets are going to be much, 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 much better than a food sensitivity test to actually determine what sensitivities the person has, because you do that diet for 60 days or 90 days, and then you start adding one food at a time every 3 days, one portion per day for 3 days, and then you see if there's a reaction. And if there is a reaction, then you see that if there's a reaction, then you take that food out and you know there's a sensitivity, and you leave it out for 6 months before you reintroduce it again. If a person puts food back in and there's no reactivity for those 3 days, they make it a normal part of their diet and go on to the next food, one normal portion per day for 3 days. That's your gold standard for food sensitivities today. Still, the lab testing is not as good as that. So I, number one, recommend doing an elimination for at least 30 days, preferably 60 days, and then reintroduction, one food at a time every 3 days, so that you know that you've had enough time for those delayed 24-hour or 48-hour sensitivities to show before you go on to the next food. And if they show, person re-regulates, feels normal again for a day before you then go on to the next food. So that's the process for doing food sensitivities. That's the gold standard. But testing can be helpful, can be useful later on down the road after you've done, let's say you've done elimination reintroduction, you've treated SIBO, you've treated everything that came up on a stool test, you've done a leaky gut protocol and gut repair protocol, and someone is still having some digestively related or skin issues, that's when you might look at food sensitivity testing. You might also look at chronic infections and toxic burden and other deeper things at that point. So my recommendation is, if you're going to do food sensitivity testing, use IgG testing primarily. If it has some complement on it, great. If it has some IgA on it, great. Mostly use the IgG testing. And then you can do allergy testing as well, IgE testing, which may even be more useful. Okay, hope that helps on the food sensitivity and allergy and giving you a real understanding of the immune system and the immune impacts and when to use that kind of testing and how to sequence it with other testing and when to be able to just use elimination and reintroduction. On to the next question here. So I'm going to share screen. Okay. This is a pretty simple question. I don't need to share screen for this one, actually. So how many capsules is it safe or healthy to take in one day? If a person has many issues and you're using supplements to address them, you can easily get to 40 capsules per day. Is this excessive? Can the body deal with 40 capsule shells? Not sure what they're called. Can you please discuss the number of capsule shells you would find healthy versus excessive per day? Thanks. Okay. Thank you, Nicola, for that question. So this is a great question, a practical question, a clinically applicable question, because there's absolutely a threshold that a person reaches, if not for physiological reasons, for psychological reasons. People sometimes have their limit on how much they're going to take. And there may be a dilution of the focus of your treatment protocol and what you're actually achieving. And so it is important to be aware that when you're giving supplements, they can add up. And they can easily add up to 40. Now, talking just a little bit about capsule shells. So some are made of cellulose, some are made of gelatin, some are a combination, some are neither of those things because they're a tablet and it's compressed into a tablet. So it depends a little bit on what the cap is made out of. If, for example, capsules are made of gelatin, let's use that example. If you imagine for a moment taking some grass-fed gelatin, and let's say you have some grass-fed gelatin and you're taking a tablespoon of that grass-fed gelatin, and you're mixing it in with a soup that you're making, and let's say you have a third of that in a serving, you just had a third of a tablespoon, you had a teaspoon worth of gelatin. Now, I don't know how much gelatin goes into one of those capsules, but I would imagine it is nowhere close to a teaspoon worth. I would imagine that it is a minuscule amount. Also, from an energetics perspective, from Chinese medicine, there's a use for gelatin. So Chinese medicine used to use donkey hide glue is what they called it, which essentially was a way of making gelatin. And they would use it actually as a way to better digest formulas, herbal formulas. So it would be an ingredient or a part of the herbal formula, but it would be an aid in digesting the herbal formula. It was said to have yin nourishing properties. The yin is the fluids and the cooling function of the body, the ability to relax and nourishing that part of the energy system. So in Chinese medicine, gelatin is actually one of the things that's used to enhance digestion and metabolism of formulas. So I actually really like when capsules are gelatin capsules and feel that encapsulated, you know, that capsule actually may be benefiting the digestive process. Now, if someone's very depleted in stomach acid, if they're very depleted in digestive enzymes, yes, they may start to have a harder time breaking down that capsule. And especially if someone were to report seeing capsule shells in their stool and broken down, I don't hear that hardly ever. But if, of course, someone was saying that, then we'd be concerned. We might want to give some stomach acid and enzymes together with supplements in order to be able to digest and metabolize them. Cellulose capsules are probably a little harder to digest. Cellulose is very fibrous. If you think of like cruciferous vegetables are fairly high in cellulose, a little harder to digest. So I feel like cellulose capsules in general, they're adding a little fiber. They're making it a little harder to digest. They may exacerbate minorly something like SIBO. Again, it's not going to be super high qualities. I don't think it's a big deal, but I do think it's worth considering when you're getting up into really high cap amounts that you may be, if they're all cellulose, adding a little bit of fiber, adding a little bit of a hard to break down cellulose. And so you may want to consider in those cases, even if stomach acid is adequate, you may want to consider a little bit of additional if there's no symptom associated with adding some extra stomach acid and the person doesn't have any contraindications for stomach acid like ulcers or gastritis, then you might consider adding a little stomach acid and enzymes in that case, which probably come in a capsule of their own, but they can come in tablets if you want them to. So I don't have a limit other than that I want to sequence treatments intelligently and not treat too many things at the same time and not divert focus. So if someone has a gut issue, a chronic infection like Lyme, for example, let's say they have SIBO, they have Lyme, they have mold toxin accumulation, they have insulin resistance and high blood sugar in their borderline, they may be pre-diabetic, and they have cholesterol that's elevated, and they have high blood pressure, and they have excessive cortisol pattern, and they have, you know, like seven things like that. I'm not going to put a protocol together for all seven of those things, but I'm going to look for some underlying things that might be contributing to multiple different parts. We know gut contributes to hormone issues. Gut can contribute to overall immune function that can help with chronic infections. We know that gut is important to have intact prior to doing too much detoxification. So I would start, I would look at gut. I might also look at that excessive cortisol, because excessive cortisol can be causative for high blood pressure, causative for high blood sugar. So I might be looking at starting with treating the gut and the high cortisol as the primary two in the beginning. And I might put together a gut protocol that has four or five supplements in it. And maybe it's one probiotic and three antimicrobials and an immunoglobulin, for example. And then I may put together an adrenal formula that maybe I'll just pick two things. Maybe I'll pick phosphatidylserine and I'll do something like a magnolia mixture that has maybe magnolia and Sisyphus in it. And I'll do a two supplement combination for the cortisol, but I'll add meditation practice as well. And if I'm going to add another supplement, I might think about, okay, well, N-acetylcysteine has some antibiofilm. It may help with SIBO. It may also help with some of the detoxification processes because of the conversion to glutathione. So I'd be thinking along the lines of, okay, maybe I could give one or two other things. They're giving nods at these other things, but really we're giving a clear focus, like a couple of focuses to the body. We're not treating all seven of those things. We're not adding something just for cholesterol and something. But I will use berberine that treats SIBO, that can also lower cholesterol, that can also lower blood sugar. That, you know, I'll think about that. How can I use things that are going to dual or triple purpose so that we can still give a clear signal to the body and we can address multiple issues? Usually there are a couple of big things that can touch everything, at least a little bit. If you address those couple of big things, then you can see which of those other things just resolved themselves and took care of themselves. Together with the diet and the lifestyle and all the other stuff that you're doing, if you're diligent about that, if you're really getting people to honestly, significantly change their diet, change their lifestyle, start to meditate, really do an elimination diet on top of the other work that you're doing, a lot of that stuff's going to take care of itself. Their blood sugar may normalize, but maybe the hypertension is still there after you treated some of that. And then maybe you switch the SIBO treatment to gut repair treatment, but you're adding in some hibiscus to help lower that blood pressure. You're addressing potassium levels and you're making sure they're getting enough potassium in the diet. Maybe you're even supplementing with up to 3 grams of potassium a day in a safe way with meals, potassium citrate, gradually over that meal, no more than a gram per meal. Maybe you're doing that. Maybe you're, you gradually add these things in. But if you see a person and you start with a couple of big focuses, you see what starts to get better, you have them still measuring their blood pressure, still measuring their blood sugar, then you can start to see what's solving itself. So usually I end up, with starting with a dozen or less different things, but they may be taking 3 caps twice a day of a couple of those things. And if a couple of those things, they may be taking 1 cap twice a day, and a couple of those things may be droppers or tinctures. So it really depends. It really is significantly variable, but I wouldn't put a number on it. I wouldn't worry too much about capsules, especially gelatin ones, but I would worry about diverting your treatment too much. I would worry about overwhelming a person, because if you're, some people just, they reach their limit. Sometimes I'll ask people, I'll say, hey, what's your threshold? There are about 12 things I really want to use here in your case. I think we'll get the best results if we use all 12. What's your threshold for capsules? We're talking, some of these things are going to be 3 twice a day. We're going to use, one of them is 5 twice a day. One of them is just 1 twice a day. We're looking at a total of, 30, 40 caps a day. Is that okay with you? Or if not, where's your threshold? And then I'll ask them and they say, well, you know what? I'll do 5 things, but no more. And I'll say, great, let's start with 5 things. And then we'll add those in. And then often after a month or two, they've been taking those 5 things. It's totally normal. They're used to it. It's not a big deal to add 3 more. So it's a negotiation. And I'll mention that also pill trays can be incredibly helpful for this, Because if someone has to open 12 different bottles 3 different times per day, that's ridiculous in today's world. That's difficult for people to do. So I'll say that that's something that you may want to really pay attention to, is also adding in some convenience factors, like handing a person a free pill tray where they can preload a week's worth of supplements. So getting some pill trays and, you know, preloading those and giving those to people, or instructing them on how to preload them for the week, is often going to be a great way to improve your ability to have more supplements for people. Okay, on to the next question. Okay. So here we have 72-year-old who recently tested quite high on Nagalase. So for those of you who don't know, Nagalase is an enzyme that's secreted in high amounts from cancer cells or viral cells. So a functional optimal is around 0.8 or less. So 2.32 is quite high. We don't know if that's because there's cancer or high viral activity, but if someone's been screened for and has no other evidence of cancer, then it may be high viral activity, and it's most likely to be high viral activity. Now, this person is 72 years old, so we have to consider that cancers do become more common as people get older. We all have some cancer cells, and we don't want to dismiss that. It could be cancer, but it looks like the report is that there's no evidence of cancer, so there's been some investigation into that, so we're assuming viral. So if we're assuming viral, then we're going to look at chronic viral treatment, and it looks like that's being done right now with supplements. She's planning on getting a knee replacement in October. She's very concerned that she may not be able to have surgery because she has an infection, as indicated by the Nagalase test, and infection is a big risk with surgery. I explained that it is different types of infections. She has a viral infection like perhaps EBV, and the infection risk with surgery is bacterial infection. I've said these things are different things, and it won't affect surgery. Am I correct? What do you think? FYI, I personally had to have knee surgery in an emergency situation, and I had high Nagalase / viral infection. It was fine. Yes, typically bacterial infections and more acute infections are the bigger concerns for surgery. Certainly a chronic infection could be a concern in surgery, but mostly we're highly concerned with acute infection. So if we're dealing with acute bacterial infection, that's the worst for surgery. If we're dealing with acute viral infection, I might be concerned to some degree, more just for recovery purposes than for necessarily, like an infection at the site of the surgery. And then, of course, bacterial chronic infection, I would be minorly concerned, but not very. For chronic viral infection, I would not be very concerned as well. Now, there's, of course, chances that the immune system has a little bit of, extra impact on it, but it's not the kind of risk that surgeons are talking about for having an infection during getting surgery. So I agree with you. I would not be so concerned about high Nagalase level being a contraindication for surgery. Now, I would think through, making sure that pre and post surgery, you're doing some supportive measures to help with recovery, with especially things that are going to reduce oxidative stress and are going to not they're not going to disrupt the healthy inflammatory process, but they are going to help the body to resolve inflammation. So avoiding, you know, things that are avoiding things like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that will prevent the resolution of inflammation, but maybe using some things like curcumin and some things that are going to help with the resolution of inflammation, fish oil, things like that. So those are things post-surgery to think about. And okay, so next we have, okay, related to SIBO, what is the protocol and consideration when anti-vinculin and anti-CDTB are positive, one or both? So for those who don't know, there's a test that was developed by Dr. Mark Pimentel, and this test was looking at immune system reactivity against a protein called vinculin. And vinculin is a protein that's involved in it's involved in the migrating motor complex. It's part of the nervous system that flushes bacteria out of the small intestine to the large intestine, and is part of the way the body gets bacteria to be lower in the small intestine. And without that proper functioning in the migrating motor complex, there may be a worsening of and a development of SIBO. It's one of the root causes for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, is this antibody against vinculin. And anti-CDTB antibodies are actually healthy antibodies that are against a toxin, cytolethal distending toxin B. And this toxin, CDTB toxin, we know is released by certain bacteria. We know for sure Campylobacter jejuni are bacteria that can cause food poisoning, that can release this toxin. It's healthy and normal for the immune system to create an antibody against this toxin if a person was exposed to this toxin after being exposed to food poisoning, for example. So this scenario could be someone, you know, let's say they got food poisoning, they were sick for a day or two, they felt better, and they were fine for several months or even a year. And then they started gradually, little by little, to get bloating, and then maybe diarrhea, and then they started to have more severe bloating every day, diarrhea frequently. That might be something where they would never think back to that food poisoning having been the cause, but it could be with the way this particular mechanism works. So this particular mechanism is started by food poisoning, where the immune system creates an antibody against cytolethal distending toxin B. And it just so happens that there can be a cross-reactivity between cytolethal distending toxin B and vinculin, a protein that's healthy in the nervous system that regulates migrating motor complex and barrier integrity as well. So leaky gut can be associated with problems with vinculin as well, a little bit more the migrating motor complex, but think leaky gut as well. So then there's an issue with there being motility properly functioning during fasting and between meals. And so we're going to see a buildup gradually over time. Remember that 3 months or 6 months or a year or 2 years after that food poisoning episode, maybe bacteria is built up enough to start to cause symptoms. So there may be a delay, and it may be a significant delay. So there's a lack of a connection. So there is a lab test for anti-vinculin and anti-CDTB antibodies. You can get that test through Vibrant Wellness. It's called IBS Sure. There's also through Quest Diagnostics a test. I forget the name of it. It changed names. It might be IBS Detect. but that may be the old name, so I'm not sure if that's the old or the new name. I don't like the reference ranges from Quest. They're not very good. They don't make sense to me. And then Mark Pimentel has put out a test of his own. So if you look up Pimentel anti-vinculin antibodies, you'll find his test, and that is a great one. And that one can be covered by insurance, and the reference ranges are good. Reference ranges are good on the Vibrant Wellness one. That one's not covered by insurance. So, but the rate is a little less expensive than the rate on Pimentel's if insurance doesn't cover it. So when you see elevation here, you know root cause of SIBO was from motility issues. And you're going to want to think through motility treatment. These are where some of the drug approach would be low-dose naltrexone. And low-dose naltrexone could be applied for 6 months or a year or longer. And depending on whether it's constipation type or diarrhea type will depend a little bit on the dosage of LDN, but you're looking at somewhere between 2.5 milligrams to 5 milligrams. Many times we'll start people at 2.5 and slowly work them up to where we find the sweet spot. Oftentimes it's around 4, 4.5, sometimes 5 milligrams. And we'll do usually that at night, especially if it's a constipation type or constipation predominant. We might do 2.5 twice daily in diarrhea sometimes. Sometimes we'll still do it all at night. What LDN does is low-dose naltrexone is really helping reduce central nervous system inflammation, and it's been shown very effective in Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune disease, and this is an autoimmune issue that's happening here. So we know it has effect on the opioid receptors, and for not completely understood mechanisms, the opioid receptors do tend to impact the immune system, T regulatory cells, and immune function. So LDN is one of the prime treatments here. We also want to look at anything that's going to regulate T cells. When we look at regulation of T cells, there's a few things that can be really helpful. There's vitamin A and vitamin D receptors on T cells. So it's important that we optimize vitamin D function, and we may even use some vitamin D above optimal function for the purpose of regulating T cells. I wouldn't want to see vitamin D levels in the blood go too high, but I would want to potentially use a dose of vitamin D, maybe up to 5,000 IU a day of vitamin D, pretty commonly unless levels in the blood are going above. If they start to go above 50 or 60, then I'll back off that dose a bit. So 5,000 IU vitamin D together with K2, and vitamin A. Vitamin A, I like preform retinol better than the beta carotene form of vitamin A, especially for dealing with T regulatory cells. So there's a few ways to do this. My favorite is cod liver oil. Cod liver oil, you're going to get some preform vitamin A. You're going to get a little bit of vitamin D. And you're going to get omega fatty acids, which are also helpful and important in this particular process and for regulating T regulatory cells, immune function, inflammation. So I would do at least a teaspoon per day. A good place to start would be a teaspoon per day cod liver oil. That's going to be a reasonable dose of vitamin A. Now, you could do a short period of a tablespoon per day, but I wouldn't do that ongoingly because that level of vitamin A could get a little high for people for them to sustain long term. But temporarily for a week or for even a month, you could do it longer than a month if you're monitoring liver enzymes. But if you're not, I wouldn't go longer than a month. So a week to a month at a tablespoon per day cod liver oil could give a higher dose of vitamin A for a period of time. And then I go down to a teaspoon once a day of cod liver oil. And if we're talking IUs, we have a question of IUs of vitamin A. I would go for around 3,500 IUs per day is a good place to be for the longer term. And I'd go 10,000 IUs in the shorter term. So you could do a month at 10,000 IU. You could even do a month up to 25,000 IU. So for example, there's a 25,000 IU product by Protocol for Life Balance that mixes fish liver oil and retinol palmitate. So you could do 25,000 IU for, up to a month. And then I'd go down to 10,000 or 3,500 IU. And then definitely not go above 10,000 long-term. And if you're doing 10,000 long-term, I'd still monitor liver enzymes. If you're going 3,500 long-term, there's no need to monitor liver enzymes unless someone has overt symptoms. So look for about 3,500 IU long-term. As preform, it's different for beta-carotene. Don't worry about beta-carotene, and I wouldn't use it. So if you're going retinol palmitate or cod liver oil, my number one choice, and there is some research looking at palmitate versus cod liver oil and finds toxicity is more likely with palmitate versus cod liver oil in comparison. So I would focus on cod liver oil if you can, but if you can't, then I would, the other thing you can do are liver capsules, like beef liver capsules, for example. You could even combine three beef liver capsules and a teaspoon of cod liver oil. So you have some play there, but I'd make sure you're getting both fish oil from some source to get omega-3s covered. And some people go as high as 3 grams per day. So some of the people who are treating this like 3 grams per day fish oil, if you're going to go 3 grams per day fish oil, then you are not necessarily going to want to do all of that from cod liver oil just because of the amount of vitamin A that you would get that long term. Short term you can, longer term you'd want to go down a little bit on that. For brand of cod liver oil, I like actually Garden for Life released one that's that has a higher amount of, so I've used a lot of the Arctic cod liver oil by Nordic Naturals. But recently I noticed when I was comparing vitamin A content that there is one that I newly saw. Now some of them add retinol, so you can get higher content by adding retinol. But I don't like that. I want to get, from the directly from the fish, if possible. So the Old World Icelandic cod liver oil by Garden for Life, I recently saw. It's new on Emerson Ecologics, and it has per teaspoon, it has 4,500 IU of vitamin A. So I like that. Gets a little bigger dose of vitamin A per teaspoon, because when you look at the cod liver oil by Nordic Naturals, it estimates between 650 to 1500 IU of vitamin A per teaspoon. So obviously you get, if you're focusing on your cod liver oil, especially for its vitamin A content, the Old World Icelandic cod liver oil is getting you a better vitamin A per teaspoon, so about 4,500 IU per teaspoon. And the Protocol for Life Balance is a capsule, and it's a mix of liver oil plus retinol palmitate, and if you use it long term, because it's 25,000 IU per cap, you'll want to monitor liver enzymes for sure. So you may not want to do that as long term. So I would say on the protocol for Life Balance product, I would use that more short term, maybe a month. You could do it every other day after that, but I prefer doing something like the Old World Icelandic cod liver oil after that. So we're going to have here a mix of vitamin A. You're going to want to make sure you're also having vitamin D and K2. Vitamin A, D, and K2, they all go together, so you want to make sure to have them all. So I would do a 5,000 IU vitamin D that has at least 90 micrograms and preferably 160 micrograms of vitamin K2. And you can also use, there's a product called liposomal vitamin K2. And that one is it has a mix of MK4 and MK7. It's by Vinco. And so it's a mix of MK4 and MK7. It has a little bit of vitamin D3, but not a whole lot. It's more high in, it's higher in the vitamin K2. So you wouldn't use it for high dose vitamin C, but if you want to get higher dose on K2, that's a great one. Or you can just get a D3 plus K2 that has 5,000 IU of D3 and some K2 in it as well. I like a mix of MK4 and MK7 both, but even if you just have the MK7 at 120 or 160 micrograms, that's sufficient. And we have a question about how about the Rosita's extra virgin cod liver oil. That's actually my favorite cod liver oil in terms of freshness and purity. I like it a lot from those perspectives. It has about 3,900 IU of vitamin E per teaspoon. So that's great also in the range we're looking for. So yes, as long as if people have the budget for it, then Rosita's is actually number one recommendation on cod liver oil. If that is out of budget for people, then the Icelandic by Garden of Life would be a second choice on cod liver oil. Okay, so vitamin A, vitamin D, vitamin K2, fish oil. So you can use cod liver oil. You can also have some extra fish oil, or you can have fish. My preference is use a teaspoon of cod liver oil in the long term, maybe a tablespoon in the short term, teaspoon in the long term, and make sure people are eating close to a pound of cold water fatty fish a week. Then we're going to get that effect from higher fish oil. If they're not able to do that, then we might want to add one capsule of a high-dose fish oil like Omega Mono Pure 1300 EC by Zymogen is a really good one that's highly absorbable, and you could add one cap of that on top of what else you're adding in this case. So that would be, those would be the staples if you're able to use LDN, low-dose naltrexone, together, which it has a prokinetic effect, so it is a motility enhancer, but we're using it in this case dual purpose, both for motility and for its impact on the autoimmune response and a reduction in autoimmunity. So that plus vitamin D, A, K2, so the fat-soluble vitamins in higher quantities than most people are getting them naturally in their diet. And then people could do this with diet and lifestyle. So, you know, the vitamin D and A in particular, and K2, it's just hard. If someone's gonna, you know, really actually eat liver every day, right, then they could do it. get the vitamin A part of it. And if they're really going to spend, you know, if they have a good sun angle and they're going to really spend a good amount of time, you know, they're going to get 15, 20 minutes if they're fair skinned outdoors between 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. every day of the week, you know, they could get a lot of vitamin D that way. And if they're going to eat natto every day, then they could get vitamin K2. So they could do it from diet. It's just most people aren't going to do that. So supplements are going to be helpful there. So those would be the big things. Plus, I would also and so there's a question, if you can't get access to low-dose naltrexone from a doctor, are there supplements like Notalpro Free MMC for this issue? Actually, regardless of LDN, even if you get LDN for its prokinetic effect, I would still add an additional prokinetic, and I would use something that has some serotonin precursor or serotonin activity in it. So Modalpro would be great for that. You could use Free the MMC together with some 5-HTP would be great for that. You could use Iberogast. You might want to also add 5-HTP in that case. So I would look at the, you know, upper GI, some of the upper GI motility activators, especially in diarrheal cases. In a constipation case, you might look at the integrative therapeutics motility activator with the artichoke in it. It's a little more on the lower, the more the colon side, more the constipation side. So depending on whether it's more diarrheal or constipation would depend a little bit on which additional prokinetic, but I would add at least one more prokinetic, even if you do get LDN. If you don't get LDN, then I would look at Free the MMC plus 5-HTP or Modalpro or Iberogast, if constipation, maybe motility activator. And then I would also add something to have some of the autoimmune effect and the nervous system effect. And on the natural side, there's Chinese skullcap, or Scutellaria. Scutellaria has some of that impact, and you can get Scutellaria as a medical food. It's also in some of the custom herbal formulas that we use. I don't know offhand. Let me check and see if it's in Free the MMC or not. We have it in okay, so we put Scutellaria in our, we did not put it in the Free the MMC. That might change just because it does have a nice nervous system regulating impact, and a lot of people who are using Free the MMC are wanting that impact. But the immune activate and modulate that we carry is high in that. So that is one option. Helps with central nervous system inflammation. We also have that in our we have a product called Viral Downward Spiral, which is high in Chinese skullcap. So that would be an option. There is also medical grade Scutellaria. Let me see if I can find the product name for you for that. It's used sometimes for joints. Arthrobem. Yeah, so arthrobem has scutellaria in it. It's a mix of collagen peptides with Bicalin from scutellaria, so that's an option. Or you can just get straight scutellaria as a tincture, so that's another option. So you could go with, looks like Wise Woman Herbals and Herb Farm both have scutellaria straight as a tincture. So those are all options for alternatives to LDN for if you can't get LDN, low-dose naltrexone, or someone is unable to access that, what can they do from a non-prescription side of things. Okay, so those are the big things on the supplements, and then to add to that, it is also helpful to make sure people are fasting appropriately. Oh yeah, and for dose for scutellaria. So if you're using a scutellaria tincture, one dropper twice a day. And so then additional considerations on the lifestyle side. Fasting is going to be incredibly important to help that migrating motor complex to happen. 4 to 6 hours between each meal with no calories, and a minimum of a 12-hour fasting window from last calorie in of the day to first calorie in the next day. Better if you can also have some intermittent fasting periods of 16-hour fasting windows or 18-hour fasting windows, eating in a 6 to 8 hour window, maybe a couple of days of the week would also be helpful as well. So those are things that you can consider on top of the supplements for from a lifestyle perspective, and that will be what you'll want to do in the case of anti-vinculin and anti-CDTB antibodies. Okay, next question here. Okay, so there's a trace elements for hair tissue mineral patterns and HPA axis ordered from a naturopath. Is that a reliable test? So yes, hair mineral analysis is reliable in the sense that it will show you a reliable reflection of the minerals that are in the hair. That's, you know, those are tissue stores of minerals. Those aren't going to be the same as what's in the blood. So you may not see a correlation between blood mineral levels and tissue levels. It's also a longer term thing because it takes a while for hair to grow. So you can get a sense for some possible long-term deficiencies in minerals being able to get into hair. I've used a test in the past, hair mineral tests in the past. I don't use them currently. I don't think they're invalid. I'm not using them because I think they're invalid, but I don't think they're the most useful. I think there are some more useful ways to gauge mineral deficiencies and mineral patterns and the patterns, you know, I haven't researched to what degree those patterns or ratios of one mineral to another being actually associated with HPA imbalance are. I know there's some people who talk about that. I've seen some of that information, but I haven't investigated research enough to say like, hey, this is bogus, or hey, this is valid in terms of the ratios being indicative of something like HPA axis imbalance. I would certainly always move, you know, on blood DHEA levels or a good, you know, cortisol awakening response in the saliva or a urine-based 4 or 5 times in a day adrenal pattern in the dried urine, I would default to those before looking at those mineral patterns. Not to say they're inaccurate, just I don't, you know, have as much data. I haven't researched them as much. So it's female, 38 years old, eczema, mild digestive issues, itching under arms, lower energy than used to have. Told she had anemia, mercury toxicity, and adrenal issues, but not hypothyroidism. Epstein-Barr, has liver, qi, lower stomach acid, better said alkaline stomach. So, okay, so lower stomach acid or alkaline stomach. Test ordered from her doctor was the hair analysis through trace elements in her doctor's office and energy machine, measured acupuncture points to give some feedback for health complaints and other tests. Suspected body-mind relationship, environmental root causes, glyphosate, fertilizers, chemicals, EMF, heavy metals, mold. Non-serving diet, lifestyle, so vegetarian, a lot of grains, no dairy, low sugar. Okay, so vegetarian with no dairy. So I'm immediately wondering, are eggs consumed? Because that'll make a big difference in ability to get certain nutrients like choline. So if you're on, if whoever's on can type in the chat, if you know, if you happen to know for this person, if they eat eggs, will you type that in the chat? So no dairy, low sugar. Stress maybe has a medium role. No mental, emotional, spiritual dynamics that we're aware of in this case. Made a lot of positive changes in her diet. Okay, and it looks like she does eat eggs, great. So eating eggs will be helpful in order to be able to get certain nutrients like choline. So, and she eats fish too. Okay, great. So eggs and fish, yeah, she can get a lot of nutrients there. So she's eating 1 to 2 pounds of fish per week. If she eats shellfish, then we can get a lot of minerals from shellfish, get a lot of B12, get a lot of zinc from shellfish. So that would be helpful. Certainly eggs are helpful. You know, maybe 10 eggs a week as a minimum, at least the yolks, to get choline requirements met. So I think that's really helpful. So definitely maybe 10 eggs a week for choline, also for protein, and then 1 to 2 pounds per week cold water fatty fish is going to be potentially helpful. So with eczema, fatty acids are important. And, you know, with eczema, I immediately think gut. But I also think fatty acids, and I also think zinc, and I also think fat-soluble vitamins. So I think with eczema, we're going to want to look at a couple different things. I think potentially vitamin A. So itching under arms, itching, you know, eczema with itching could be histamine related also. So immediately I'm thinking digestive issues are going to be prime to treat. So, you know, having anemia, well, is that iron deficient anemia? Is that, you know, microcytic or macrocytic anemia? Is it fully, more fully B12 side, more iron side? Either way, if she eats shellfish, iron and B12 can both, they're extremely high in clam. So eating clam on a regular basis would be extremely helpful in this case. Adding in, if she does shellfish, some oyster might help with some zinc levels. So shellfish, especially clam and oyster, would be really helpful. And then cold water fatty fish for fatty acids for sure, and protein and some B12. And then eggs for choline. It's not specified what type of anemia. So either way, shellfish are going to be helpful in resolving gut issues, because we know iron is more deficient in cases of SIBO, and so is B12. So testing for and treating small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, getting a GI map and looking, or a CDSA with parasitology would be worth doing straight off the bat. That's going to be key to treatment here. In the meanwhile, adding some clams, adding some oysters, if she'll do shellfish, adding 1 or 2 pounds cold water fatty fish per week, closer to 2 if she can tolerate it, and adding at least 10 eggs per week, making sure she's eating those. Mercury toxicity. So if that's true, then I think there's, in addition to whatever else is being done, chlorella is incredibly important. So I would look at prime chlorella tablets and maybe do 10 tablets 3 times a day would be great. If you get the enhanced chlorella tablets, those have more growth factor, and that was really helpful, or that can be really helpful. And she was eating tuna, I think. Okay, yeah. So for mercury, we obviously want to avoid tuna, want to avoid swordfish, want to avoid, we'd want to focus our cold water fatty fish on wild salmon, sardines, maybe some halibut, some herring, some mackerel would be fine. A lot of sardines and wild salmon would be great. So those would be good ones in her case. And then taking chlorella, 10 tablets 3 times a day would be great. It could be the enhanced chlorella tablets or the regular chlorella tablets enhanced would be slightly better. Adrenal issues, but not hypothyroidism. So adrenal issues don't specify low or high. So it depends on the pattern. If it's low cortisol, low DHEA, high cortisol, low DHEA, high cortisol, normal DHEA. So that's all important. For brand, for chlorella, I like prime chlorella. And prime chlorella is, it comes in tablets or powder or capsules. I like the tablets. And I prefer enhanced chlorella tablets. You can get them direct from Prime Chlorella, or you can, and you should be able to make a wholesale account with them, or you can, if you have access to Mountain States Health Products, which is kind of like an Emerson or a Natural Partners that has a lot of different brands, they carry Prime Chlorella on Mountain States Health Products. So you can look at ordering direct from Prime Chlorella or Mountain States Health Products. And if you order 5,000 tablets, that's the best deal, but it's, an investment up front. So people have to be wanting to take it for a long time in order to warrant that. So that would be really helpful in general for the mercury side of things, and for covering some nutritional bases as well for binding toxin. I take it 30 to 60 minutes before a meal would be ideal. So for adrenal issues, it's going to depend. Either way, you could do an adaptogenic herbal formula. You could look at some ashwagandha, you could look at some rhodiola, you could look at some Eulerithrococcus. You could look at a general adaptogenic formula, combine some of those. You could look at Schizandra. Those would be fine either way, but you want to look and see, is it more high adrenal anxiety, high blood pressure, high blood sugar, really wired all the time? Or is it more low adrenal, like, tired, really fatigued, low blood sugar, low blood pressure, needs more salt, that kind of thing would be more of a low adrenal pattern. So it depends which way she goes as to how to design a more solid pattern. So, high or low is going to be really important there. But we can say for sure an adaptogenic herbal formula, whether it's high or low. And if it's high, phosphatidylserine, magnolia. If it's low, looking at maybe an adrenal glandular, extra salt, looking at licorice potentially. We need to know if it's high or low. Epstein-Barr, so is that a past or a recurrence presently? Has it, you know, do we have a lab on that? Or is it just a history? I wouldn't focus on it if it's just in the history. If it's got a lab showing recurrence presently, then I might add in some things like L-lysine, lorazepam, maybe some vitamin A. I would think, you know, about some cod liver oil for preformed vitamin A. Low stomach acid. So when there's low stomach acid and anemia, that could be B12 anemia, and someone who's vegetarian, I'd think antipyretal cell antibodies is a possibility. If you could get antipyretal cell antibody blood test, that would be fantastic. And if that's above 20, then B12 injections for sure. If you can't get that test, you could just proactively do B12 injections or get a 10,000 microgram methyl B12 sublingual. I know Protocol for Life Balance carries a 10,000 IU one. Or you could do two tablets of a 5,000 IU one. And I would do that daily for a while here. Just, you know, if you can't get more labs, it's safe, it's non-toxic. I'd start with that right away. If you can get more labs, I'd look at antipyretal cell antibodies. I'd see if you could get, you know, you could look at a methylmalonic acid in the urine or blood as well. And for the lower stomach acid temporarily, you could give, a betaine HCl or an enzymes with a HCl. And I would do that in the meanwhile. And then, you know, eczema, mild digestive issues, itchy underarms, and lower energy than used to could all be explained by digestive issues. So I definitely, you know, in terms of next tests, I'd prioritize SIBO and something like either GIMAP or CDSA with parasitology times 3. Those would be, you know, the biggest priorities. And then I'd look at, if you can get additional testing, antipyretal cell antibodies and a CBC to see, you know, where that anemia is, and maybe an Epstein-Barr recurrence panel to see if it's recurring. Those would be additional optional tests to get more information if possible. And then immediately, you could definitely start with some of those dietary changes, 10,000 IU of vitamin B12, some cod liver oil, and get that going all right away. And I'd make sure to check vitamin D too in the blood testing if you can. And then glyphosate, fertilizers, chemicals, EMF, heavy metals, mold. Yeah, if you suspect mold, then, you know, that's something worth digging a little deeper into. Heavy metals, obviously, we have mercury already. We'll start addressing that with some chlorella. Yeah, glyphosate, fertilizers, chemicals. So some of that can be avoided with some dietary stuff. So I think that's a good place to start. SIBOs, you know, get some gut labs. That's, you know, that could cause all of that. So really get gut labs, start with the dietary suggestions of the shellfish and cold water fatty fish, and eliminating the tuna but doing the other fish, and getting the clam and the, you know, especially clam, maybe some oyster too. Seeing if you can sort through what kind of anemia, and adding the, you know, the gut work is going to be key there. And then chlorella. So next question we have here. Okay, so 50-year-old female, underweight, inability to gain weight. Okay, so underweight with an inability to gain weight, pain in the upper right side near liver gallbladder area, sometimes acid reflux, definitely bloated, issue with mold 3 years ago. She thinks her building has mold too, but she's okay. She has energy, easy to fall asleep and stay awake through the day. Mercury amalgam, she knows she has mercury toxicity, and aluminum was too high from her mother's cookware. Ears clogged, taking herbal for yeast, and that helped. Yellowish skin, grinding teeth. No pain anywhere in the body except when she eats high fat or dried fruit in the upper right side. Normal daily stools, non-floating, dark color, healthy diet. Working on diet for at least 3 years, very clean, organic, cooking at home. Extra virgin olive oil, small amounts, always raw, wild game, pasture, chicken, breast. Paleo for 3 years. Last year added some beans and grains like millet and quinoa. No alcohol for more than 15 years, before it was only occasional. Food sensitivity to nuts, seeds, eggs, soy, rice, chocolate, cocoa oil, macadamia nut oil, banana, sweet fruits, dried fruits, dairy, high-fat foods like organic grass-fed red meats, chicken, dark meat. She has tested fiber in America that didn't show all the sensitivities she has. So yeah, sensitivities are going to be often, you know, there are sensitivities, going back to this discussion, there are sensitivities that show up in food elimination reintroduction that will never show up on a lab. So, you know, we want to take those as the gold standard, but also they change over time. So if they're not allergies and they are sensitivities and a person's been avoiding them for a year or more, it might be worth reintroducing and seeing if they do okay with them. A mitochondrial test showed a flag in 2017, 2018, it went back to normal. Sister has a liver issue also, but not alcohol. All of them underweight, never breastfed. Autoimmune arthritis has been negative. C-reactive protein tests normal, waiting for GI MAP test results. SIBO tests will be ordered soon. Dunwoody test for leaky gut was positive 1 year ago. So the leaky gut Dunwoody test also measures for histamine. So if you know, will you comment about whether histamine was high or DAO was low? Dunwoody labs oxidative stress was positive. Okay, good to know. Supplements from Zymogen and Science for Health. Thyroid panel shows slight hypothyroidism, but ultrasound is negative. And then we have some labs. I'm going to share screen on the labs here. Okay, so here we have a CBC differential with platelets, and so underweight, inability to gain weight seems to be the big issue here. If that's not the chief complaint, will you please, you know, type in what is the chief complaint? But that was the first thing mentioned, so I'm assuming that's probably the chief complaint. And then also, will you mention if you have any other information about whether okay, weight's the big issue. Okay, and then okay, so weight's the big issue. Here's the CBC here. we see that white blood cells came in below normal at 2.8. So that can be indicative of chronic infection sometimes when white blood cells come in normal, if it's repeat times. Now, this is one snapshot in time. We don't know if this is repeat times, but low white blood cells can be a flag, so we should consider that as a possibility. And when we do, we want to look at the percentage of neutrophils, lymphocytes, monocytes, eosinophils, basophils, and the absolute numbers of those. And we see neutrophils are less than lymphocytes. So 39% neutrophils, 48% lymphocytes. So neutrophils at 1.1 is below range. Normally we see neutrophils about double. So about 60% is normal on neutrophils, about 30% is normal on lymphocytes. So when we see this ratio skewed with neutrophils being 39%, 1.1, lymphocytes being higher, we see neutrophils low. And that pattern, together with white blood cells being low, can mean chronic viral infection in some cases. Could be chronic bacterial, could be chronic viral, but I'm thinking in, you know, light of there being potentially some type of infection. And then it looks like she's not eaten nuts for a long time, but it doesn't matter how long she stopped eating them. She has issues. Okay, good to know. Started about 5 years ago. Before that, she was normal. She could eat them and eggs and dairy. Okay, so about 5 years ago, she had some changes with nuts, eggs, and dairy. Now, nuts have fiber. Nuts can be, you know, nut intolerances can be a byproduct of things like small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So can dairy, because the lactulose in dairy, the lactose, not lactulose, lactulose is the substrate for SIBO breath testing, but lactose in dairy, that can be created from SIBO. So, for example, dairy and maybe even some nuts could become potentially able to be eaten again post-SIBO treatment. Eggs, it's usually more the protein in eggs. Nuts, sometimes it's the protein, but sometimes it's the fiber and the carbohydrate. So nuts and possibly dairy, again, could be in dairy the lactose, or could be the protein. If it's a lactose, it's likely that SIBO treatment will make it better if SIBO is present. So she could develop a tolerance again to lactose and nuts after some gut work, which is great. Okay, so low white blood cells, low neutrophil lymphocyte ratio, that could be chronic infection, could be viral or bacterial, could be an autoimmune pattern, but it looks more like with white blood cell being low, if that's chronically low, that looks like more potential for chronic infection. Then we see homocysteine came in at 9.5. 9.5 on homocysteine is borderline. It's a little higher than I'd like to see it. It's not excessive, but I'd like to see it more like 7 or 6 would be nice. So with homocysteine at 9.5, I'm thinking, well, is there deficient B12? Is there deficient folate? Is there a methylation issue? Is there inadequate choline? Is there inadequate vitamin B2? These are some of the thoughts that start to go through my head. So I'd wonder, is there MTHFR, methylation issues? If she's not eating eggs, is she getting adequate choline? That's one of the first things to look at, since she's eating meat. It seems like she should have enough B12, but maybe she's having a digestive issue and not able to metabolize that vitamin B12. So B12 is on the table for me. If she's not eating, so it sounds like she's eating some beans. She may have some legumes, depending on how much leafy greens she's eating. You know, she's eating enough. So for folate, we think legumes, leafy greens, and liver, the three L's. She's eating all three of those, or two of the three, in pretty high quantities. Then she should be getting adequate folate from diet. Now, whether she's absorbing or metabolizing it is a question, especially with low weight, with bloating, you know, with sometimes acid reflux. These things can mean she's not absorbing very well, but she's probably getting enough in that case. So she may not be getting enough choline. If she's not eating liver and she's not eating eggs, it's unlikely, and she's not eating nuts, it's unlikely that she's not getting very much choline. She eats meat every day, once a day. She eats lentil and beans a lot. So does she eat liver? If she doesn't eat liver, I'm suspecting choline deficiency is part of the issue here, no organ meat. Okay, so either she should start eating liver or take liver capsules or have, so she can't digest them. So then she may need a choline supplement. So choline can be derived from either soy or sunflower. If she has a soy problem and it's a protein, she may still be able to tolerate lecithin from soy because there's not much protein in it. It's mostly fat. But if it's a severe soy issue, then sunflower choline will be better. So she can get sunflower lecithin. It can be, if she tolerates soy okay, or if she does fat from soy, and you know, if it's not the protein from soy, then you know, phosphatidyl choline powder from Designs for Health is a great supplement, but it is derived from soy, so you have to be, you know, aware of that. As long as that's okay, then, you know, she can do the phosphatidyl choline powder from Designs for Health. If soy is not okay, then she could do sunflower lecithin. There's encapsulated sunflower lecithin and liquid sunflower lecithin. So those are options. So phosphatidylcholine would be great to add in here. That may help bring homocysteine levels down, optimize methylation a little better. And I would probably also do a B complex to cover the bases on the B vitamins. And make sure it has methylated forms of folate and B12. But not big doses, don't need to do big doses. I just do a regular, you know, B complex, like B active from Zymogen is a great one. So I do that one cap once a day. And then I do, and Zymogen does have a choline liquid that's amazing. It is very expensive. This depends on budget. If budget allows for it, you could do that. If not, I do the sunflower lecithin. And then I do a cap of the B complex. And then here we have fasting glucose came in at 70, which is a little low. 75 to 85 is usually what I like to see. 70 is starting to be, you know, I start to wonder about hypoglycemia. So if she has especially symptoms of getting dizzy easily, irritable when she skips meals, stuff like that, then I'd be thinking, well, hypoglycemia, probably an issue. And I'd be working on fibers and fats and also all these gut issues like SIBO and anything that comes up on GI map. So then it looks like kidney markers look normal. Sodium and potassium look fine. Potassium could be a smidge higher. So, you know, some extra starchy tubers, if she tolerates starchy tubers like potato, sweet potato, plantain, you know, those could be good. Chloride, carbon dioxide look normal. Calcium looks normal. This mitochondrial antibody, this one came back normal. Apparently it was abnormal before. Then we have some organic acid markers. Here when we see erotic, so orotic, this is ammonia excess marker. This came up high. So in her case, I think number one intervention to try to reduce ammonia would be to add some arginine. And I would add at least, so for arginine, you can do capsules or powder and I would do, I would make sure that there's enough arginine to, you know, that's fairly significantly elevated. So I would want to reduce ammonia by a significant amount and to make sure we add arginine in. And I would do probably, on doses for arginine, there's some research on nitric oxide levels and different arginine doses. And so there's a place to start and there's a place to work it up slowly. And I would probably start at maybe 1 gram a day would be a good starting point. And you could work up to, you could work up to a total of 6 grams. That's a lot. So I don't think, and it can start to cause diarrhea at 6 grams. So I would be cautious when you get up to 6 grams, but I would definitely go up to 3 grams. So I started 1 gram, work your way up to 3 grams over several days. And then I try going up to 6 grams, but if there's diarrhea, I would go back down a little bit. So 3 grams you can get up to pretty quick in just a few days. Then I'd go over a week, or you know, over 2 or 3 weeks, I'd slowly build up to 6 grams per day. If there's diarrhea, I'd go down to the highest dose that's below 6 grams but does not induce diarrhea. And if a person drinks caffeine at the same time as they take arginine, it can worsen diarrhea. So I would take it at a different time than caffeine. If she's working out, I would take it about a half hour before exercise to add the net benefit of nitric oxide production with exercise. And we're going to want to, you know, be having the ammonia cycle be impacted by this. So nitric oxide production is not necessarily the only thing we're looking at, but I would consider that, you know, that's going to be the most likely thing to help. Citrulline can help too, but so you could add citrulline, but I don't think you necessarily have to. I think arginine is going to be the number one thing that's going to help, and then the possibility of citrulline as well. And I would stay at, once you get to the 6 gram dose, I'd stay there for several months. I'd at least do 3 months and maybe up to 6 months. So that's something to consider here. And you're going to want to be, ideally, you could get a retest on this organic acids that would tell you when to stop, or you can look at symptom changes and when she's feeling a lot better, stop. I do a minimum of 3 months on that. And then, so 2-hydroxyhippuric can often be GI bacteria. That's a further indicator that there might be a bacterial overgrowth of some sort. So I'd definitely be looking at testing for and treating bacterial overgrowth. Then uracil came up high. I wouldn't pay too much attention to that. It can be related to autism. Is a lot of times when these markers come up for the pyrimidine metabolites, it can be related to folate as well. With the homocysteine on the borderline, you know, I'd make sure she's getting enough folate, but I'm not too concerned about this uracil elevation here. For ketone and fatty acid oxidation, we have ethylmalonic and methylsuccinic acids elevated. These are ones where I would think about fatty acid oxidation. And I think about carnitine in these cases. And so carnitine is both beneficial for mitochondrial function as well as for fatty acid oxidation prevention. So I would, in this case, look at the I'd look at adding at least a gram of carnitine and maybe up to 2 grams of carnitine per day. You have to use a little bit of caution with carnitine with people with hypothyroidism. So trying to see if hypothyroid was on this case. I don't remember if it was. Thyroid panel showed slight hypothyroidism. So with slight hypothyroidism, I would use some caution going as high as 2 grams a day. I would focus, probably start at 1 gram per day of carnitine to help with making sure to shuttle the fat into the mitochondria. I'd also, the choline is also going to help fat metabolism. And so between choline and carnitine, we're going to get some good benefit for being able to hopefully be able to metabolize fat a little better. I'd also think about glycine in this case, both because homocysteine elevation was slight. So I'd think about glycine. So you could get glycine from collagen. If she's willing to take collagen, you could do maybe 20 grams of collagen once a day. And you could also consider you could consider powdered glycine in 3 grams, 2 or 3 times a day, either instead of collagen or in addition to, depending on whether she's doing collagen or not. But glycine can help with methylation. It can help with sleep. She doesn't have a lot of issue with sleep, but methylation, there may be a slight issue. And it can help with bile acid formation and fat digestion. So some collagen might be helpful here. Looks like B6 is borderline high here, which means low. So some of these high values mean low on the vitamins. Some of them low values mean high on the vitamins. So the ones that are marked with a star mean that that high values can mean deficiencies. The ones that aren't usually mean low values are more associated with deficiencies. So vitamin B6 is near the top of this range. She may be taking some vitamin B6. I'm not worried about that. Vitamin C, though, is low, so I would add some vitamin C, especially because there's also a sign of oxidative stress. You said she came up positive. You could look at regular old vitamin C. You could look at a liposomal vitamin C. Either way would be fine. I'd take about, you know, at least 1 gram, maybe 2 or 3 grams per day of vitamin C. And then next we see here that 2-oxoglutaric, no, that's not too far out of range. It is one of the mitochondrial markers. She had a mitochondrial thing in the past. She has these 2 markers here. I don't know if this test was from the past when she had that mitochondrial issue, but I'd consider a mitochondrial stack. So in addition to carnitine, I'd consider CoQ10, maybe 200 milligrams once a day of ubiquinol. And I'd think about NAC, N-acetylcysteine, maybe 1 gram once or twice a day. And then I'd think about, which could help with biofilming, could help with SIBO too. So that could be nice. So carnitine, NAC, CoQ10 are all potentially going to be helpful there. So I would do a mitochondrial stack in her case and combine carnitine, NAC, ubiquinol. So at least those 3, that would be a good start. You certainly could, you can go as far as you want with mitochondrial stuff. I would add some alpha-lipoic acid too because of the oxidative stress. So I do 300 milligrams alpha-lipoic acid once a day, 1 gram of carnitine once a day, 1 gram of NAC twice a day, 200 milligrams ubiquinol once a day. And I'd add that in as a mitochondrial stack. And then it looks like dopamine could be subpar. If people take 5-HTP for a long time and they don't take any tyrosine, they can create a little bit of skewing and some dopamine deficiency. So I'd think about some tyrosine and or Mucuna for some dopamine in her case. So Dopa Boost is a design for health supplement that has some Mucuna and some tyrosine, especially if focus is an issue. And then I would look at SIBO. You said you're working on that test. Okay, so that's a wrap here. So basically in her case, we're looking at arginine, and we're looking at the gut testing as the big things coming up. And then we're looking at some mitochondrial support in the meantime. There may be a chronic infection, and I would look in the gut first for that anyway. So I think you're on the right track with doing gut testing. For now, you can add in the phosphatidylcholine from lecithin, sunflower lecithin. You can add in the mitochondrial stack, so the carnitine, NAC, alpha lipoic acid, and ubiquinol. And you can do some of the stuff that we talked about in terms of testing for SIBO and GIMAP. So that should get you going on that case there. So it looks like we had one more case here. We are at time, but real quickly, it's rashes in back, neck, chest, belly, red dots, like eczema, a 1.5-year-old. So eczema in a 1.5-year-old, you're going to have to look at what mom's eating and what the baby's eating. Citrus can be, a thing. It sounds like when eating berries, redness around the mouth, there could be a histamine thing. There could be a reactivity. Dairy, citrus, these are common ones. Mother thinks it's fish. That would be reasonable to suspect as well. So yeah, you can definitely consider yeast here. You can consider gut issues here. There are some infant-based probiotics. It sounds like dad's not a big fan of probiotics at this point. But food reactions, some elimination, both from mom and baby, can be important there. And then, especially if mom's still breastfeeding, it doesn't say, 1.5 might not be. So then it would just be baby if mom's not breastfeeding. And then boy, 3.5 years, loose stool, smelly gas, rough skin, underarm rash, always hungry. Brother 5 years old is the same, plus underweight. So I would think SIBO immediately. So I'd test for SIBO, maybe a stool test as well. Looks like you're thinking parasites and yeast. So yeah, stool test, great. SIBO, great. Test for those, treat those. All righty, that's a wrap. Thanks, everyone, for submitting all the great questions. Keep submitting questions, and we'll catch you next time. Have a great evening.